Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, you guys ready to start?
Yes.
It's 5 after 7. If we start now, I can get you out of here on time. Theoretically, don't start with me. I'm injured. Lay off.
Yes, sir.
I'm very glad and thankful that Tom was able to fill in for me on Sunday, so let me just publicly thank him for that.
Very ably.
Very ably, yes.
It was a blessing.
One of the advantages of having somebody like Tom around, and this again is one of the benefits of sound doctrine and a church that is theologically grounded, we could pick just about anybody who's been here for a little while and say, stand up and tell people what you believe, and it's going to be cohesive. It's going to be the same theology. We're not going to have anybody stand up and say something outlandish that's going to cause a schism. They're going to stand up and say the same things that we all believe because we've taken the time to ground ourselves in the Word and in theology and in doctrine. And Tom and I have been together for 25 years. My goodness, there's nobody around who knows more about what I believe than Tom does. He's got a firm grasp of it. So that makes me very fortunate, very blessed in that if I have to lay down and skip a Sunday, I can, knowing that everything's going to be fine, congregation's in good hands, because the man that's there is not going to try to cause a schism of his own. And then, despite himself, I got here tonight, and people walked up and said, what are you doing here? I said, well, who were you expecting?
Tom.
Tom! I said, well, we're expecting Tom. So apparently, the schism has begun. So if you want to start your own little offshoot group, you know, you're ready to go.
Tomites
and the Jimites. Yes, we can.
We could.
Mm-hmm. And then we can immediately start branding each other heretics and calling each other cults. So we can start right away. Turn to Numbers 18. I remember where we left off 2 weeks ago. Last week, we had the baptism service, which was very nice and very enjoyable, and the folks at Sovereign Grace Baptist Church were very gracious to us in opening their building and their hearts to us, and so we enjoyed it, and they enjoyed it too. And when I told them that we were planning future expansions and that one day we would have our own facility for baptisms, they said, no, we want you to keep coming here. And so they were very nice about it. One thing we did learn, however, last Wednesday night, is that apparently no one trusts Alan's driving. That's what we discovered. At least that was how he read the situation.
None of these people were here.
None of them would ride with you, I know. One by one, they dropped off going, no, I can't ride with Alan, no, I guess I should also add, thank you very much for all the people who sent emails and notes on Facebook and people worried about me. I even got phone calls from internet listeners saying, are you okay? You were missing. It's rare for me to be missing. I haven't missed a Sunday morning at GCA in 5 years. Even if I wasn't the one preaching, I was here. Even when I was sick, I was here. And I really believe, I told Tom this, I believe that providentially, as you said, Tom had the message that needed to be preached Sunday morning. And God knows that unless I'm disabled or on fire, I'll show up here. And so he knew that he had to make me lay down in such a way that I would get out of the way so that Tom could bring the message that Tom brought. And so I'm very grateful for that. Thanks for all the cards and letters and worries. And I'm decidedly better, thank you. I'm hobbling around, but I'm much better and hope to just keep healing from here. And I'm hoping, and if you want to pray for your pastor, pray this, that I get smarter. Because I hurt myself on Saturday through rank stupidity. I knew better than to try to stand up that way. I know better. I just decided I was 21 again and leapt up off the floor as if I was, you know, a Russian gymnast. And that's just not the way my body works anymore. And so I got hurt from that. So pray that I have the wisdom to remember that I am as old as I am, and then I won't do that again. Last night, my daughter took me to see a movie to get me out of the house since I'd been cooped up since Saturday and was determined to get out. And we decided to go see a comedy. So we went and saw the movie The Invention of Lying. I don't know if you've heard about this movie, but the guy who wrote and directed and starred in it, Ricky Gervais, we like the other stuff he's done. He created the TV show The Office, and he's just a funny guy. But he is also decidedly agnostic, if not downright atheistic. And in all of the coming attractions and everything that we saw for the movie, it looked very humorous. And so we were hoping it was just going to be a good comedy, a good night out for my daughter and I. And it started out fine, started out as a good premise. The premise was that this is the world where no one knows how to lie. No one ever has lied. People just tell the truth, but they don't even have a word for truth or a word for lying because it's not something they've ever had to describe. Everybody just says exactly what's on their mind, which of course makes people brutal in their honesty. And then his character is the first one who figures out how to tell a lie. And because no one has ever encountered lying before, they believe whatever he says. It must be true. Nobody would not tell the truth. And so the first half hour was very amusing. And then the invention of lying became the invention of religion, specifically biblical Christian religion. And the big center of the movie then became that the reason religion exists is because gullible people will believe whatever you tell them. So the comedic premise became a philosophical premise for explaining how gullible people believe things like the Bible. And this is a very common premise that I see in a lot of the debates and email and discussions that I have. It's very common to hear agnostics and atheists build their argument on the notion that people 2,000 years ago were just much more silly and foolish and stupid and susceptible than we are now, and superstitious, yes, that now we're much smarter. Now we're grown up and graduated. And I just had a Facebook discussion a couple months ago with a young atheistic fella. I've mentioned these conversations before, but this same guy, one of his arguments was, well, we're so much smarter now. And I said, really, what's your evidence that we're actually that much smarter now? And his evidence was the internet and computers and stuff like that. And so I had to try to explain to him that what that means is that we have greater immediate access to information, but that we ourselves are not any smarter. Spend an afternoon reading the comments on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Or an afternoon just scanning the sort of things that people say on Facebook or Twitter. Yes, they have all this technology. They have this mammoth amount of communication technology. And what do they use it for? To say the most inane, pointless, stupid, misspelled, bad grammatical things you can think of.
Amen.
When they have spell check.
When they have spell check. And nevertheless, I was thinking about that and thinking, you know, my folks, my parents, didn't have the internet. And as a consequence, they never felt the necessity to tell people every trivial thought that went through their head. Because smart people know enough to not burden other people with every trivial thought that goes through their head. But now with Facebook and Twitter and stuff, you have people saying things like, just went to the grocery store, just had ice cream, coming home from work. And they put these things on their blogs or their Facebook or the whatever else, these little comments. And so I was talking about it the other day and said, that would be like my mom finishing a dish of ice cream and then feeling it was necessary to call everybody she knew and saying, just finish some ice cream, bye, and then running out on the front lawn and yelling to all the neighbors, just finish some ice cream. And we laugh at it because we know that everybody would go, so what? We've lost that sense of so what. We've lost that sense of privacy and even that sense of discernment that lets us know when we're sharing too much. There are so many things. Now, I've got close to 300 friends on Facebook now because people, you know, who know us on the internet, who hear me preaching and stuff, find me on Facebook. Can I be your friend? Yes, yes. So I say yes to everybody. Yes, you're my friend. Yes, you're my friend. And then I'm careful about what I put on there because whatever I do put on there, people react to because I'm that preacher guy. So pretty much anything I post on there gets reaction. And yet, because I have that many friends, anytime I look at Facebook, it's a litany of comments by 300 people. And as I scan through it looking for anything that might be valuable, the vast majority of it is completely trivial information. I say all that to say, we may have more access to technology to express ourselves, but the way we're expressing ourselves doesn't show any higher intellect. If anything, it shows that the thoughts running through our heads are in fact completely trivial, and that we share them with people. So there's no evidence that human beings today have graduated to a higher state of actual intelligence than people 2,000 years ago. But here's the point that isn't getting argued, I think, adequately enough in these discussions. So I'll share this with you, and then we'll get to numbers. Because I didn't get to talk Sunday. So I have all this stored up information. And besides, Tom came up short time-wise, according to the men in the back of the room. And so to me, that's like a bank I can call. Never mind. All right, so. Here's the thing that not enough people are paying attention to when it comes to the foundation of Christianity. Let's suppose for a moment that Christianity was an invention and that liars did make it up. And that they made it up for their own self-interest. That they made it up because they thought that they were going to gain some positive benefit to themselves. Which, of course, we know the Christian story. None of the apostles or founders of Christianity gained anything personally from it. They all died horrible deaths as a result of what they knew apparently was a lie. But if you and I were going to create a lie about something that happened in Smyrna. Let's say that Tom and I got together and we decided to conspire a story about Alan. And we were going to... you look too gleeful. Yeah. You know, just as I said that, he thought of four or five things. Just like that. If we were going to conspire a story about Alan that was really... genuinely, beyond belief, beyond the everyday norm, the way the Christian story is. And we wanted to say that Alan, let's say, walked across the water. Now, are we going to go circulate that story in Smyrna where people know Alan and can find Alan and can find people who know Alan and who can check that story? Well, of course not. We're going to go to Detroit, you know, we're going to go to Europe, we're going to go to Mexico, we're going to go somewhere where nobody knows Alan, where nobody really knows anything about Smyrna, Tennessee, hopefully that have never heard of GCA, and then we're going to say, there was this guy, and I'm telling you, he walked across the water, because we know that there's very little opportunity for them to check the story. And yet, all of the New Testament writers name names, places, locations, and then after telling this really tremendous genuinely fantastic story, then said, and it happened in Jerusalem, and they brought that story first to the people in Jerusalem. The very people who would be able to say, well, that never happened. The very people who would say, there was never a Jesus. There was never a real human named Jesus. There was never a guy named Jesus who died on a cross. Now, of course, the first place that Christianity moved and really got a large foothold in a large metropolitan empire place was in Rome. By the time that Paul wrote his letter to Rome, Christianity already had a foothold in Rome. Paul hadn't been to Rome when he wrote his epistle to the Romans. And yet he was able to name names of Christian households where both the Jewish church and the Gentile church were meeting already. That's how quickly Christianity got a foothold in Rome. And so, if you want to disprove Christianity, if Christianity is a lie, then this story about the crucifixion of Christ includes specifics like there was this Roman procurator named Pontius Pilate, and his wife had a dream, and Jesus appeared before Pilate. Now, if you're a Roman cynic, who are you going to talk to? You talk to Pontius Pilate. He's findable. He's locatable. You're going to go to him and say, is any of that true? Did any of that happen? See, my point is, if you're a liar, you don't make up the story and spread it to the very places where it can be checked. The whole Christian story of Christ on the planet and his crucifixion and his resurrection takes place in Jerusalem under Roman dominion. The people who get the blame for the crucifixion of Jesus are the Jewish leaders and the Roman government and leaders. So you don't start by spreading the story there. You take the story to India, where nobody knows any of these people. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And yet, because it was a true story, and because the apostles were true reporters of what they actually experienced, they took the story right to the hardest audience to sell if it's a lie. Only if it's true can you take it to that audience. Only if it's true can you go to Jerusalem and Rome and tell that story. And more amazingly, when they took it to Jerusalem and Rome and told that story, it was believed and the story took off. Which it doesn't do if it's a lie among the people who know it's a lie. If it's a lie among people who know it's a lie, they're not going to die for it. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. When you start feeding Christians to lions, and the Christians know it's a lie, the Christians know that they've checked, and it turns out there never really was a man named Jesus in Jerusalem, and that Pontius Pilate did not oversee any trial, and that there was no King Herod, or maybe there was a King Herod, but he didn't really get involved. And you understand what I'm saying? These are all details you can check. And so my point is this. The popular premise that the reason people believed Christianity 2,000 years ago is because they were just not as smart as we are today. There were plenty of cynics back then. There were plenty of people who wanted to stop the preaching. That's why so many of the apostles ended up in prison. It's why all of them were ultimately killed. It was all to stop the preaching. Secular history tells us that. You can read Tacitus, the Roman historian, and he will tell you that the Christians were persecuted, that they were persecuted by Nero. We know that this is true. We know that within 40 years of the actual events, there was a massive outbreak of Christianity and persecution against Christianity. We know these facts. Pliny, you can read him too. But also Josephus. You can read secular reports of the reality of the outbreak of Christianity. How do you explain the outbreak of Christianity in Rome and in Judea if those are the very people who know none of it's true? None of it happened. I don't care how susceptible, foolish or silly, you claim people are. When you start killing them for it, they're going to say, okay, never mind, we made it up. We don't need to die for this. That was just a lie. We have no proof of any of this. And so the people who come along 2,000 years after the fact and want to convince you that there wasn't even a Jesus, He didn't even live. These are all old wives' tales made up by men who wanted to exercise some kind of power over other people, so they just made up a religion. That is the most senseless version of an anti-Christian argument there is, because it completely ignores the historic realities of how the Christian gospel was first preached, who preached it, who they preached it to, and where history tells us Christianity broke out. It broke out among the very people who would know if it was true or not. You understand?
Yeah.
So here's my point. Save your $7. Don't go see The Invention of Lying, despite the fact that it started out funny and ended kind of cute. But the big middle section is yet another regurgitation of the same old, really pointless, very simplified. Oh, let me make this one last point, and then I'll be done. If you wanted to convince the first century people in Jerusalem that there was no Jesus, that the God of the Bible was not real, that the Old Testament was a bunch of wives' tales and, you know, just stories made up by men long ago, if you wanted to convince them, you better come with an argument, because they lived it. They were there. They experienced it. Even his critics saw the miracles. Even his critics, the ones most responsible for his ultimate crucifixion, couldn't deny that he had a huge following of people who said he's the king of Israel based on the power of the miracles he did. So if you're going to try to convince them that Christianity is not true, you better come with an argument, and you better have a good argument, and you better have a solid argument, because these people know what they know. 2,000 years later, the argument is nothing more than, oh, people were gullible and it was all made up. And people believe that. So don't tell me people are any smarter now than they were back then. 2,000 years ago, you had to bring an argument. Today, you can make up any silly thing and people will believe it.
That's true.
I say people today are a whole lot stupider than they were 2,000 years ago. And by the way, if you don't think that's true, go out and whip up a pyramid. Build yourself a pyramid. Because at this moment, historians and archaeologists are still arguing about how in the world they built those things. Yeah. How did they do this? Well, we still don't know. But, you know, they were dumb back then. Or as I often like to point out, once the earliest explorers got into the pyramids, they found painting on the wall. To this day, they continue to dig up ancient Egyptian finds that still have hieroglyphs on the wall that are in excess of 2,000 years old, 24, 25, 2,600 years old, and the paint is still on the wall. We can't make a paint that lasts four good winters. But they've made paint that lasts 2,600 years. Don't tell me we're smarter now. Back then, they knew how to take important information and carve it into the stone because it was important. Now people throw away every thought they have out there in the digital ether, and it exists for a second and it disappears. And it's hard to figure out what's important because we're inundated with too much information now. So we have information overload and apparently no greater intelligence. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. That was all introduction. Well, thank you, dear. I'll give you your money afterwards.
I thought it was brilliant, too.
Oh, you heard there was money involved. Oh, and you just jumped right in. Like, oh, I'm brilliant, too. Get in on that pool. Okay, as you may recall, 2 weeks ago, the last thing we saw was that the people of Israel rebelled against Moses and Aaron and said, how come you're the leaders? We're all equal here. Argued for the standard Arminian, God loves everybody, just the same argument. And so God decided once again to prove his ability to pick and choose. Had the leaders each take a stick, write the name of their house on it. But the stick, the rod that belonged to Aaron, became the rod for the tribe of Levi. And that rod budded, showing that God had chosen not only Aaron in specific to be the high priest, but the tribe of Levi to be his tribe of service. then chapter 18, right on the heels of that, goes back to these are the duties of the Levites. So now that God has separated them again, he drives home the teaching again that now that I've separated you, now that I've said you are mine, here's your job. Here are the requirements. And that'll take us through verse 8. So let's just read those out because you'll be familiar with them. They are the same rules and standards that we've heard previously laid out in Leviticus. We've already heard these rules. Starting at verse 1, so the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons and your father's household with you shall bear the guilt in connection with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the guilt in connection with your priesthood. But bring with you also your brothers, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve you while you and your sons with you are before the tent of the testimony. And they shall thus attend to your obligation and the obligation of all the tent, but they shall not come near the furnishings of the sanctuary and the altar, lest both they and you die. And they shall be joined with you and attend to the obligations of the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent, but an outsider may not come near you. So you shall attend to the obligations of the sanctuary and the obligations of the altar, that there may be no longer wrath on the sons of Israel. And behold, I myself have taken your fellow Levites from among the sons of Israel. They are a gift to you, dedicated to the Lord, to perform the service of the tent of meeting. But you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything concerning the altar and inside the veil, and you are to perform service. I am giving you the priesthood as a bestowed service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. And several times God has demonstrated that. Several times people have approached his tent the wrong way, whether with strange fire or whether in rebellion, and each time God has killed them to prove that he's real, real serious about this. Starting at verse 8 then, and for the balance of this chapter, and we'll try to get as much of the chapter in tonight as we can, but there's a lot that we're going to have to kind of stop and talk about. The balance of this chapter is God telling Moses to tell all the children of Israel that they are to bring to the high priest and to the Levites the best of what they have. So now think about it for a moment, because God is going to say, now Aaron, here's the deal. Okay, you won't find the phrase, now Aaron, here's the deal in the text. It's an old Hebraism. Never mind. God says, Aaron, you're not going to get an inheritance of land when you go into the promised land. You're not going to get a land inheritance that you can grow and pass down to your future generations. Your sons, your daughters are not going to get a land inheritance. But I'm going to make everybody else in Israel bring you the best of everything they have. And it's going to be yours and your sons and your daughters, and you're going to eat from it and live from it because it's all yours. And then everybody in Israel has to bring a tenth of everything they have and give it to the Levites. And then the Levites have to give a tenth of the tenth to Aaron. Now think about that for a moment. Doesn't that mean, theoretically, that Aaron could potentially be real well off?
Yes.
I mean, this guy doesn't really have to worry about anything materially. He's got a million plus people required to bring not just something, but the best. And then on top of the best of what they have that they have to bring to the high priest and his family, they then have to bring a tenth to the Levites, and then the Levites have to give a tenth of all that to the high priest, which means that the high priest gets 1% of the total product of all Israel constantly on top of the continual offerings of the best of everything they have. One family in Israel. Does God have the right to do that?
Yes, he does.
Because we struggle with that. The reason we struggle with it is because in the modern church, we've all seen the abuses that happen when money is brought up, We all see the men who set themselves up in the modern church as the modern-day prophet or the modern-day priest, and then tell everybody, now bring the best of what you have and bring it to me. And then they get themselves Lear jets and satellite uplinks and mansions and bathtubs of gold and say, well, I deserve it. I'm the man of God. I'm the man of God. I contend that anybody who could do that while there are people in their congregation starving and struggling doesn't have the mind of God in the least. But there are also people who, in order to maximize the amount of money that they can get from their congregation, impose the tithe on their congregation. Now, I'm sure that everybody in this room, without exception, has taken the time by now to go to our website and read my book on New Covenant Giving. In that book, which you really ought to read, I took the time to explain the way the tithes work. I am convinced biblically that a tithe is a tax placed on Israel for the support of the Levites. God's going to say it here very plainly, very exactly. And you might as well know, if you're into the tithing scheme, the tithing is much more than 10%. As God continues dealing with Israel, he starts with the tenth that you give the Levites. But that's just ground level tithing. And by the way, that's the tithe you bring after you've brought the best of your stuff to the high priest. So you bring your best stuff to the high priest, and you bring your first fruits, and you bring all that, then you get to your first tithe. But as God continues dealing with Israel, he places other tithes on them, including a tithe that is specifically for widows and orphans and the poor among you. That's an every third year tithe that is used to build up God's storehouses. And there actually were in Israel storehouse places where you would bring your tenths to build up something that the Levites could then distribute to the people who had need. Then there was yet another tithe on top of that that virtually no preacher I've ever heard, no tithing preacher that I've ever heard, ever talks about this other tithe. Because if you're really tithing, you've got your 10% of the 100% after you've already done, you know, your mandatory offerings. Then whatever's left, you do your 10%. So you've got 90% left. You have to give a tenth of that. That's another 9%. So you've got like 81%, but you've got to give another tenth of that. And that last tenth is you have to store up between the Jerusalem feasts because you're required, everybody that can travel, every man that could travel was required to show up 3 times a year in Jerusalem for a feast. You couldn't show up empty-handed for those feasts. So you had to set aside your third tithe for the feast so that when you came to the feast, you had something to feast on. Have you ever heard a tithing preacher or a TV tithing preacher up there talking about your tithes? Has he ever told you that you eat your tithes?
Yes.
We had one.
You had one that did tell you?
Yes.
Yeah, that third tithe was something you consumed so that when you went before God, you would have something there for the feast because it's a feast before the Lord. In fact, the rules go on to say that if your tenths that you've collected, which include your animals and your produce and your grain, everything, if those tenths became more than you could comfortably take to Jerusalem, you were allowed to sell those tithes, take the money in your hand, and when you got to the feast, use that money to buy, the language is, whatever your heart desires, including food and strong drink. Party on your tithe.
Yeah, blow it on yourself.
Blow it on yourself. Have a great time on your tithes. So there are many tithes. Tithing is not as simple as bring a tenth of everything you make to the church. Because to begin with, the church is not the storehouse. Storehouse is very particular language of storehouses in Israel that were set aside to feed the widow and the fatherless and the poor in Israel, and also to be used by the Levites. The constant 10%, the first 10%, was for the support of the Levites, and we don't have Levites anymore. And so there's really no justification for any of the tithes because we don't have the Levites, we don't have the storehouses, and we don't have the feasts. We don't go to the feast in Jerusalem anymore. So there's no new covenant, New Testament justification for Old Testament tithing. And by the way, the very first chapter in my very good book, which you should have read by now, called A Guide to New Covenant Giving, the very first, I think, chapter in that book is called The Escape Clause. And I point out that Paul said, let every man, according as he purposes in his heart, so let him give. Now that is the absolute inverse of systematic, mandatory, required tithing. I got into a debate a couple of years ago with a tithing preacher who didn't like that I was putting these things out on the internet.
Not bad.
Yeah. And that some of his congregation had come across this teaching. And he felt that it was undermining, you know, the financial base that he was using to build a bigger building, you know. What'd you say?
Ruined his budget.
Exactly. It got right into his budget. In fact, you know, the big church up the street, I won't name their name because they keep changing their name, but the big church up the street, they've been advertising for a couple of years now their direct deposit straight from your checking account tithing. They'll take 10% of your money straight out of your checking account to make it convenient for you. They call it giving without the effort. Well, New Testament, New Covenant giving is supposed to require effort because it's supposed to be sacrifice. You're supposed to feel it. You're supposed to know that you're doing this out of a loving response for everything God has done for you. If it can be done without the effort, you're not doing it right. But the escape clause, the New Covenant, New Testament escape clause, is let every man give according as he purposes in his heart, so let him give. And so this preacher was arguing with me and saying, no, when Paul said that, he meant above and beyond your tithe. And then he said, because that church would have already known to tithe, because that's a mandatory requirement. And Malachi says, you know, he goes straight to Malachi, they all go to Malachi, and say, you know, God said, you've robbed me. Wherein have we robbed you? In gifts and tithes and offerings, you know. So you're robbing God if you're not tithing. That's the very common argument. And then they say, so the church would have been tithing already, and then they would give whatever they wanted above and beyond the tithe. And so I wrote back to him and said, you do realize that Paul is talking to a church at Corinth of Gentiles who would have no history of tithing, no background in tithing. They're not under the Mosaic law. They don't know anything about Levites. They're not out trying to support the Levitical system. They wouldn't know to tithe unless he told them to. They wouldn't know to tithe unless he taught them to. And there's not a word in any of Paul's letters to Gentile churches, not a word about systematic, mandatory tithing. Instead, he says just the opposite and says, whatever you determine. Now, let me also add that Paul does expect that every man's going to give. You will notice in that clause, every man as he purposes in his heart, so let him give. The expectation is always giving. But the difference is now, instead of it being a mandatory rule on rebellious Israelites that they have to support the Levites, in the New Covenant, we now have people who are filled with the Spirit of God, who, because of the grandness of the salvation that we have, generosity and grace and kindness ought to then flow from us. The paradigm that I like to lay out and demonstrate is that God is preeminently a giving God. There's nothing you have he didn't give you, from life to breath to intelligence, culminating in he gave his son. Nobody ever gave a better gift than that he poured out his wrath on his son instead of you. What a great thing you received.
Amen.
He gave you this wonderful gift because he's a giving God.
Mm-hmm.
He sent his son, who is also a giving God. He gave his life. He laid down his life. He did it willingly for his people. He gave himself for our offenses. He's a giving God. And then, as we've been seeing in the book of John, he said, it's good for you if I go away, because if I go away, the Holy Spirit will come, which is the Holy Spirit of a giving God. And God gives the Spirit, and the Son gives the Spirit, and you are the recipient of all this grace and outpouring and kindness, including the giving of the Spirit that takes up residence in you. Now, I refuse to believe that a giving God can give his son, who would give his life, which would give you the Spirit, and when the Spirit gets to you, that's where the giving stops. I refuse to believe that when it reaches you, that was the whole point. It reaches you and you go, okay, I'm good now. It's time for me to store up as much as I can for me. No, the giving continues because the Spirit of God working through us continues to drive the kind of grace and kindness that the giving God would, of course, exhibit in his people. How do we get to there? Okay, so I jumped way forward. I'm way ahead of myself at this moment. But I wanted to kind of create a framework for what we're going to read here in Numbers, because this is the beginning of God, a giving God, telling the people of Israel, now you're going to give. But in dealing with people who don't have the Spirit of God residing in them, who are rebellious people, he must tell them, this is a rule, this is a law, and you have to do it. And you have to bring it to support my work, my Levites, my temple, my tabernacle. Now they're going to rebel against it. They're going to stop doing it. And they're not going to keep his Sabbath. And they're not going to, because, after all, they're just rebellious, stiff-necked people who don't have the Spirit of God driving them to do the right thing. In the new covenant, this is why I keep saying, giving, like every other facet of our worship of God, is created anew. Everything's made new in the new covenant, including how and why we give. And the giving in the new covenant is the result of all the giving God has done, and the result of our salvation, and the result of everything we know about ourselves. Instead of being a rule by which God judges us, it is a response to how God has saved us. Got all that?
Yep.
Still all introduction. It's 10 to 8, and I'm ready to dig in. That'll teach you to let me lay down for a week. It'll just teach you. Verse 8, then the Lord spoke to Aaron. Now behold, I myself have given you charge of my offerings, even all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel. I have given them to you as a portion and to your sons as a perpetual allotment. So as long as there's a high priesthood by the sons of Aaron, then all the gifts that all Israel bring as holy offerings to God, God said, now they're mine, and because they're mine, I can do whatever I want with them, so I'm giving them to you. This shall be yours, verse 9, this shall be yours from the most holy gifts reserved from the fire. In other words, don't burn these things, these are yours. Every offering of theirs, even every grain offering and every sin offering and every guilt offering, which they shall render to me, shall be most holy for you and for your sons. As the most holy gifts, you shall eat it. Every male shall eat it. It shall be holy or separated for you. Verse 11, this also is yours. The offering of their gift, even all the wave offerings of the sons of Israel, I have given them to you and to your sons and your daughters with you as a perpetual allotment. Every one of your household who is clean may eat it. All the best of the fresh oil, and all the best of the fresh wine, and all the best of the grain, the first fruits of all which they give to the Lord, I give it to you. Wouldn't you like that deal?
Yes.
You get like 1 million people who have to bring the best of what they have to you. Wouldn't that make him, as I said before, a pretty well-to-do guy? Now, does God seem to have any problem with that? Because remember, all the children of Israel were required to bring the best of what they had. He didn't say, now everybody who has plenty has to bring a gift. Because everybody within Israel is required to worship God. So it was simply a matter of the best of what you had out of what you had. That's why I think Paul could say, every man according as he purposes in his heart, because then every individual knows what they have, what their capability is, what they can bring. The assumption is that everyone will bring. You might recall the story of Jesus watching people put money into the treasury, and he saw a widow put in two mites, less than half a penny. And he used her to compare her gift to the people who were giving out of their excess. So there were people who were rich and had plenty, and they would show up and blow a trumpet and make a big show and put some money in the treasury. And Jesus was totally unimpressed because he said, well, they give out of their plenty. They got a lot. If some people, there are some people in this church who if they give $20 on any given Sunday, that's a lot. $20 means a lot to them right now. They're out of work. They're struggling to get by. And they give 20 bucks, and that's a big sacrifice for them. And God honors that as a big sacrifice. There are other people here who are fine, got good jobs, doing fine, own homes, making their payments, and if they gave $20, it would be an insult. It'd be like tipping God. Like, God, you've given me all this stuff, and I'm doing great. Here's 20 bucks. Keep it going. So it's not the amount. God knows what you have and what you can give and what you can afford to give. And so the widow walked up and put, compared to everybody else, put a pittance into the treasury. And Jesus said, she gave more than all of them. He said, because they gave out of their plenty. She, out of her lack, gave everything she had, her whole living, and gave it into the treasury. 2,000 years later, we're still talking about that woman. We're still talking about the demonstration of that woman because Jesus took the time to point it out and say, see what she did? Now, you'll notice that Jesus did not go and say, woman, take your 2 cents back. Well, not even. Take your half a cent back. Go and take your two mites back out. That's your whole living. You're going to need that. Now, you see demonstrations of this throughout the Bible. God first, God first, God first. Elijah, when he came to the widow's house. Do you remember the first thing he said to her? Make me something to eat. She said, we got nothing. We got so little that I am picking up sticks to go home, make a fire. We're going to eat the last of our meal, and then we're going to die. And that's the plan for me and my son, because we got nothing. And he said, well, then feed me. So she did. And from that point forward, they had plenty of food. And as long as he was in their house, the oil never ran out and the meal never ran out. And they had plenty to eat because they prioritized God. And she didn't just give. She gave all she had. And God honored that because God, after all, is the God of absolutely everything. So when God talks about giving, whether we're talking about new covenant or old covenant giving, there is inherent in the instruction a blessing behind it. And God's going to say it here. If you do it my way, I'm going to take care of you. After all, I'm taking you to a land of milk and honey. I'm going to take you to a place where there's plenty of food. All you got to do is remember to bring me the first of it, which I then assign to my priests, which I can do because it's mine. And if you just do it my way, I'll take care of you. And in both the Old and New Covenant, you see that consistent testimony, put God first, he'll take care of you. But then what we do, because we're so human, is we go, oh, I don't have enough God. So I'll hold back a little bit. I argue, no, when you don't have, trust God. That's the best time to trust God. It's kind of like Barney Johnson saying, pray first. Don't start with, I'll cut God off. Start with, you know, I don't need to go out to lunch every day. I can cut back somewhere in my own enjoyment of life and keep putting God first. But I'll tell you a story. I was sitting in my apartment in San Francisco. This would have been 1981. And we were between record deals. We were moving from one label to another. We were being sued by everybody we ever knew. And I had an attorney in those days who told me once, you will be able to gauge the level of your success at any given moment by how many people are suing you at that moment, because the perception will exist that you have money. And when that perception exists, people will come try to take your money. So anyway, there were lawsuits flying, and then we're between deals. And so I had to just scrape by for a few months until the next record deal was in place. We got our advance, all this kind of stuff. I was down to literally my last $40 in my checking account. It's an absolutely true story. And that was the beginning of my Christian conversion. I think I told you before, Easter of 81 was when I heard the message of the resurrection and walked outside and said checkmate to God, and it was the beginning of my conversion to Christianity. And so I had $40 left, and I decided I was going to send that $40 to the man who had preached the message who brought me back to Christianity. And I remember very clearly saying to God, if I'm going down, I'm going down swinging. You know, if that's it and I starve and die tonight and it's all over, at least you're going to know the last money I had I gave to you. Want to know how it turned out? That was 1981. It's now 2009. I'm still standing here. I own a home. I've got a car. I could probably lose a couple pounds. God took care of me all these years. All these years. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, God reacted to my $40 and said, okay, there, now, finally, that's the $40 I was waiting for. But what I'm saying is I learned a really important lesson that night, which was keep God first. And what I can tell you for certain is he's been faithful ever since. And I've never, never missed a meal. When I was out this week sick, people were showing up at my door with too much food. Marilyn called and said, can we bring food? I said, no, I've got enough food. I got here tonight and Gladys said, oh, we meant to bring you food. I said, no, I got food. I'm good on food. God has taken care of me all these years. And so whenever I get greedy, because I do, because I'm human, whenever I want to hold on tighter to what I have, I remember my $40. And I remember that when I just let go of it, God took care of me all these years. The problem is when we try to clench on too tight to what we have and think that that's what's going to save us. I've only got this, so I'm going to hold on to it. This is my last meal, and me and my son are going to die. When you hold on tight to it, that's when you're in trouble. When you let it go, God will take care of you. He has a long, rich history of doing it. Anybody want to testify?
I've never been hungry.
There you go.
Than you are.
Yeah. Couple verses and I'll let you go, because I'm kind and my back is starting to wear out. Verse 12, all the best of the fresh oil and all the best of the fresh wine and of the grain, the first fruits of those which they give to the Lord, I'll give to you. The first ripe fruit of all that is in their land, which they bring to the Lord, shall be yours. Every one of your household who is clean may eat it. Every devoted thing in Israel shall be yours. Every first issue of the womb of all flesh, whether man or animal, which they offer to the Lord shall be yours. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man you shall surely redeem, and the firstborn of an unclean animal you shall redeem. Why did God throw in, you'll redeem the firstborn animal or the firstborn man? Do you remember what that goes back to? When he delivered Israel out of Egypt, and then he killed all the firstborn of Egypt, he then said, now all the firstborn of Israel are mine. But then once he took the Levites to himself, he said, I'm taking them in exchange for all your firstborn. So the firstborn still belonged to God, but because he took the Levites, he said, you buy them back. And you may remember in the book of Leviticus that he laid out the rules, the redemption rules, how much it would cost for every firstborn to be redeemed. So he says right here, now even though they're technically mine, because I've taken the Levites, definitely redeem them. So that there's no chance that anybody later would say, well, that looks like a strapping young guy, I'm going to put him into service. It's like, well, that's not up to you. Only the Levites now belong to you for your service. Verse 16, and as for their redemption price, from a month old you shall redeem them by your valuation, 5 shekels of silver, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, which is 20 gerahs. And that ought to clear up the amount for everyone. But the firstborn of an ox or the firstborn of a sheep or the firstborn of a goat you shall not redeem, they're holy. Those are the clean animals that can be used for sacrifice. So you couldn't buy those back. You shall sprinkle their blood on the altar and shall offer up their fat in smoke as an offering by fire for a soothing aroma to the Lord. And their meat shall be yours, and it shall be yours like the breast of a wave offering and like the right thigh. All the offerings of the holy gifts which the sons of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and your daughters with you as a perpetual allotment. It is an everlasting covenant of salt before the Lord to you and your descendants with you. Then the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in the land, nor any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the sons of Israel. Starting in verse 21, he gets into the tithe. We'll pick up there next week. But I just want to mention that phrase where he said to Aaron, when you go into the promised land, you're not going to get a portion of land. You're not going to get an inheritance. You get me. I am your portion. And that language has carried all the way through the Bible and even into the New Testament and the New Covenant, that God is our portion. God is our inheritance. While we are here, we have no permanent home, nor is any possession here on the planet ours permanently. When you die, you leave it all behind, but in exchange, you get the portion of God. And that is the essence of what the gospel is all about. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. Right?
Right. Right.
I almost broke out in song, but not quite.
I'm coming back to visit the earth. I want a seat full of knowledge of the glory of God.
By the way, I think we will. I mean, that's the point of the New Jerusalem. Yeah, when it's all said and done, you know, people get this notion.
Strange place.
Right, people get this notion that the ultimate end of Christianity after you die is that you're just off in some ethereal woo-woo land. But there's a resurrection coming. And when the resurrection comes, we will be like Christ, who was as comfortable eating fish by the seaside as he was sitting at the right hand of God in heaven. That's what we're getting. And then new heavens, new earth, new Jerusalem. I mean, that all sounds quite physical to me, and we're going to participate in that in redeemed, resurrected bodies. So, boy, there's lots to do still.
But no curse on the earth.
And no curse. Wouldn't it be great?
Yes.
Any questions about what you heard tonight? All right, good. Thanks for being here tonight, since some of you didn't know if I would be, and since some of you came anticipating Tom and then had to put up with me. So
he was cool. He really was.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.